I want to, first of all, thank the Nussbaum family for dedicating our Medical Ethics and Halacha series. This is our last session before the summer break. I'm going to be working with Barry Pacus on new topics for next, in the coming weeks. You'll probably get a poll about that. Thank you, Barry, for all your help in helping us to get accreditation. Also want to thank Shari Shamayim for their willingness to host this in person if we were able to host in person. I'm really hoping that we can go back to in person in the fall. Understanding that we likely will have a Zoom option, certainly at the outset, and then, you know, go from there. I will note the comment that I made before we officially began, that if you registered in advance, that's great. But if you want a credit letter, then I need either for your screen to be on or for you to just note in the chat, send me a message that you are here. You're going to be getting an email, I expect, afterwards with a link for an evaluation. The evaluation is very important insofar as it's part of our accreditation process. So please make sure that when you get that link, you fill out the evaluation. If you're not a medical professional, fill out the parts other than about medical professionals. I also want to take a moment to note that my Beit Midrash has a couple of things coming up that I want to make sure you know about. First of all, Sunday is the fast of Shavuot Seder Tammuz if Mashiach does not arrive. Whether Mashiach arrives or not, we are planning to have a learning program on Zoom from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., a series of 30-minute classes, all about fasting, different aspects of fasting, about certain fasts that are on the calendar, the roles that fasting plays in Tanakh, all sorts of things that hopefully will help you have a meaningful day. The program is called Beyond Hunger, and I think when I send out the follow-up email from the session, from tonight's session, I'll include a flyer for that. And then the other is that my Beit Midrash is very happy to be able to provide these programs free of charge. We have our annual Day of Giving coming up, June 28th to 29th. Don't ask me why it's called a Day of Giving if it goes across 2 days. Some questions are just better not asked. But it's the opportunity for us to hopefully take care of all of our fundraising for the year. That's what we would like. We have some very generous families who have acted as lead supporters and have contributed, I think, almost $300,000. And we're looking to now raise additional funds from the community to complete the budget. It is not a matching program. It's simply a fundraising event. There'll probably be something in the follow-up email about that as well. Okay. Our topic, end-of-life care. This is a topic that I've spoken about a few times over the years, but it seems like every time we do a survey calling for topics, there's a request that we deal with it again. And the truth is there are some new elements I find each time that make it worthwhile to revisit. It's a nerve-wracking topic for me because the stakes are very high when we talk about this. I definitely want to say, from the beginning, that nothing I say should be taken as psak. Nothing I say should be used as the basis for a practical decision. Please consult your halachic authority for practical questions on this matter. I just reposted the link for the source sheet in the chat, so hopefully people will download it that way. The agenda, which is at the top of your source sheet. First of all, at the very top of your source sheet, you will see a link. The link is for past medical ethics, medical halacha sessions. I highly recommend that people go to that link to see the topics that we've done, because it also has links to the recordings, and that way you can catch up on things that we've done before. But right below that is the agenda. Judaism prides itself on its emphasis upon life. Almost all of Judaism's laws are overridden in order to preserve the briefest moment of life. But at what financial cost to the individual, family, and community do we preserve and extend life? And what happens when preserving life means extending physical and or emotional suffering? Is there a point in a patient's suffering at which Judaism accepts the idea of giving up? And if so, what practical steps may be taken to prevent additional suffering. By the end of this session, participants will, number one, be able to articulate the halakhic considerations relevant to end-of-life care, two, understand the critical differences between withdrawing or withholding care and medically assisted death, three, appreciate other elements of decision-making in end-of-life care, including physical and emotional suffering, community, family, and economic considerations. That's an awful lot for us to get to, even in 90 minutes. So the truth is, there are many issues and circumstances we're not going to get to fully address. We're not going to address at all the question of determining the time of death, even though that fits into the overall topic. It just won't fit. I did give you on the last page of the source sheet, if you flip to the end, some links for related sessions, which I'll refer to from time to time within our conversation. So the first link on that list is for rationing end-of-life care. That's where I really go into some of the financial issues. We're not going to be spending that much time on financial issues as part of the discussion this evening. Barry posted a link for the evaluation in the chat. Hopefully it'll also go out in my follow-up email, and you may get it in a separate email as well, and people will be able to fill out the evaluation. Okay. Whereas normally we like to have as much discussion as possible, and I still want to have as much discussion as possible, the definition of as possible changes with each session. And we have so much to talk about here that we'll have some discussion, but not necessarily as much as I would normally want for our learning experience. I gave you four vignettes on the sheet, and we're going to talk about each of them as we get to them. Right now, I'm only summing up each of them. The first one is from the Rodriguez case, which was a case in 1993 pushing for medical assistance in dying. The a case of, as you see, a 42-year-old mother with ALS. That was the case in 1993. We're going to come back to that. The second case, the second vignette that we'll deal with is about withdrawing a patient from a ventilator, or withdrawing a ventilator from a patient, I suppose. The third one is a case of withholding care, choosing not to give care. And then the last is an acute care case. The question of how to handle acute care decisions in which the patient really could live longer potentially with the treatment. It's possible that you could really cure the illness and therefore it's not purely end of life. And we'll discuss that more when we get there. Someone sent me a message asking me to share a screen with the sources, but I really prefer not to do that. That's why I send people the link for downloading it. I like to be able to see people when I'm speaking. It helps me as you know, the person presenting the class. A word of preface. Having witnessed many situations in which doctors and families, or doctors and rabbis were on opposite sides, the most important point that I can make right at the outset is the need for a humble and open mind and a listening ear on all sides of this. From the rabbi's perspective, the rabbi needs to learn the medical issues. I think that's very important, to recognize the needs of the patient, the needs of the family, and the needs of the medical professionals as well. And at times, not to be afraid to ask a more senior rabbi or a more expert rabbi for guidance. At the same time, it becomes very important that the medical professionals recognize the and respect the patient's ability or the family's ability to make up their own mind based on their own beliefs. I was in multiple cases when I was in the shul rabbinate in which a doctor took it upon himself or herself to say to the family, you know, if this were my mother, this is what I would do. And frankly, to the family, that wasn't so relevant. They, you know, what the, if they ask, that's one thing. But otherwise, that doesn't really have bearing. It's also really important to recognize a point that the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada makes. If you take a look at source number one on the sheet, after the vignettes, where they point out that there is the possibility of a conflict of interest in the sense that, on the one hand, the physician is supposed to be a health advocate for the patient. or the community, and at the same time, they have to be a manager or gatekeeper of medical resources. And so, you know, that does create a problem, and it's important that the medical professional recognize that. So that's just something that I put out there as a preface. But I want to jump into the core ethical challenge that we deal with when we're talking about end-of-life care. On one hand, we have a biblical obligation to heal. Tell me, where does the Torah say that I have an obligation to heal? Where do we find that in the Chumash? Uh-oh. So, v'rapo yirape, we take as permission to heal, but v'hashevo solo, we take as a mitzvah of restoring property, and therefore also restoring person to somebody who is ill. How about lo sa'amod al dam reyecha, do not stand by while somebody's blood is shed. V'ahavta l'reyecha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. Lo sucha l'hisalem, if somebody is suffering a loss, you're not allowed to walk away. If somebody is suffering, you're not allowed to walk away. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says one who fails to heal is a shedder of blood. It's very clear we have a duty to heal people. But as part of the obligation to heal, we are also supposed to do everything in our power to control and, where possible, eliminate pain and suffering. I gave you in source number two an example of a source that indicates just how highly Jewish law values pain, values in the sense of taking it seriously. If you're familiar with the story from the book of Daniel, in which Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are told that they have to bow to a statue, and when they refuse to bow to the statue, they are thrown into a fiery furnace. Says the Talmud in source number two, and for all my translated sources, I'm just reading out my English translation. The original Hebrew is also on the sheet. The Talmud comments, the pain of lashes may be considered a punishment harsher than death. For Rav taught, had the Babylonians whipped Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they would have served the statue. Meaning that being thrown into the furnace, they could deal with. Being whipped in an open-ended way, that would have been too much for them. That shows that there's a possibility that pain could actually have an even stronger impact and certainly stronger intimidation than death. And that comes up as a halachic source. I'll give you an example. If you take a look at source number three. Source number three is talking about a terrible case. A baby is born with hydrocephalus. And there's an issue of putting the baby on a ventilator. And take a look at what Rabbi Menashe Klein wrote in source number three. He says, if it is truly as he says, the person putting the question about the ventilator to Rabbi Klein, if it is truly as he says that the patient cannot live at all without this machine, and even with this machine he will not live, but it will only greatly extend his period as a goses. Goses is a term we're going to come back to later, but we'll translate it roughly as somebody in their last 72 hours of life. By any projection that we can make medically, this person is not surviving the next 72 hours. So all it's going to do is lengthen that period of goses survival. Then it appears one is not obligated to use this machine for the patient, just the opposite. Perhaps it would be prohibited, as it causes him to be a goses and in pain without purpose. So here you find, again, this statement of the severity of pain and how seriously Jewish law takes the experience of physical suffering, and it's not just physical suffering, it also applies to emotional suffering. So if you take a look at source number four, this is from Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, major authority in Jewish law until he passed away in the early 21st century. And Rabbi Shlomo Zalman says a lot here, which we're going to have to come back to later, but I'm only focusing on one piece of what he says here in source number four. And again, I'm putting the link in the chat for the materials for those who have joined. Please make sure to download them. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, logically, where an ill person suffers from great pain and suffering, or even very strong emotional pain. And that's the part that I want to show you here, is that he's bringing in emotional pain as a factor. He says, I think you do have to give food and oxygen, and that's something I want to come back to. But, he says, you could refrain from treating with medicine that would cause more suffering for the patient if the patient wished it. You'd be allowed to hold back because of the emotional suffering that is involved. Notice this issue of coercing the patient to receive treatment. That's another of the topics that we're not going to have time to get to today, but I did include in the links on the last page of the source sheet links for two sessions. One on following medical advice, is that an obligation in Jewish law? And the other on patient autonomy. But what we're seeing here is that on the one hand, there's an imperative to heal. And on the other hand, there's an imperative to recognize pain, recognize just how severe pain can be, including emotional pain. As a matter of fact, emotional pain is taken so seriously in Jewish law that we have precedent for a halachic approach that says one would be allowed to pray for a patient to die. There's a lot of debate about how this is implemented, but there is precedent for it. If you take a look at source number 5, as an example, the classic story of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, also known as Rebbe, editor of the Mishnah. He was dying of an extremely painful bowel condition. And Rebbe's maid ascended to the roof of the study hall. The students are all inside the study hall, praying for Rebbe's survival. And Rebbe's maid ascended to the roof and said, "The heavens request Rebbe, the earthly realm requests Rebbe. May it be God's will that the earthly realm should overpower the heavens. We want to win. We want Rebbe to stay here." Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the canonizer of the Mishnah, the leading sage of the end of the third century, of the beginning of the third century, excuse me, when she, Rebbe's maid, saw how often Rebbe had to go to the washroom, removing his tefillin, putting them back on, and how he was in great pain, she said, "May it be God's will that the heavens should overpower the earthly realm. God should take him." And the sages were in silence. She takes a pitcher of water. She throws it off of the roof. The praying ceases, and Rebbe passes away. Now, there's a lot to be said about that case, obviously. This is not a simple and straightforward thing. What I wanted to highlight was what Rabbeinu Nisim, a leading authority in 14th century Spain, said based on that story. Take a look at source number 6. He sided with the maid. He said, I say maid here, M-A-I-D, all lowercase, not the other M-A-I-D, which we're going to come back to. I have to clarify that. Sometimes one needs to pray for mercy for the patient to die, such as where the patient is in great pain due to his illness and he cannot live. So again, there's a lot of discussion about the legitimacy of praying for somebody to die in Jewish law. Some suggest that it's allowed, but that a caregiver should not pray for the patient to die because that creates a tremendous conflict of interest. It's really a bigger discussion. But my point again, and this concludes this section, is to say we have a real problem when we're dealing with an end-of-life situation in which we can't cure the patient. Or in the acute care case, maybe we can cure the patient, but the odds are against us. And the best we can do is extend their situation. Do we extend their situation knowing that that means extending a position of great pain, physical pain, emotional pain, and so on? Everyone clear on what we're asking? Okay. So I'm about to start a poll for everyone here. The poll is, first of all, your name and email address will not be registered in it. It's entirely anonymous. And it's for medical professionals and non-medical professionals alike. And the question I'm going to ask you, well, I'm going to launch it and then you could answer it. I'll read it aloud. Faced with a patient who is suffering from advanced ALS, meets the criteria for medical assistance in dying, and is requesting medical assistance in dying, would you do the following and check as many as you would do? Would you end the patient's life under medical assistance in dying? Would you provide the means for the patient to end their own life? Would you refer the patient to a medical professional who would help the patient under medical assistance in dying? Would you withdraw medical care which was sustaining the patient's life? Would you withhold medical care which would extend the patient's life? Or none of the above? So we'll give people a few seconds. We're not going to take a lot of time on this, but I think it's useful to get a sense of what people are willing to consider. We currently have 59 people, in the room, so hopefully we can, get somewhere towards that in terms of the polling. There's a question in the chat. Is the patient Jewish? Let's say yes, just for the sake of saying it. I'm not really going to get into a discussion much of whether there's a difference between Jewish and non-Jewish patients. We generally assume that there is an obligation to save all life. There may be some nuances in the law, which we may allude to a little bit later. We'll see. Okay, it's I'm going to give another 10 seconds for people to respond. That's definitely enough time to answer questions like this. Okay, so I'm ending the poll. Okay, so we got 43 votes, and the result here I will share. So 3 votes for ending the patient's life under MAID, 2 for providing the means for the patient to end their own life, 27 for referral to a medical professional who would help the patient under MAID, 8 for withdraw medical care, which was sustaining the patient's life, 19 for withholding medical care, which would extend the patient's life, and none of the above got 2 as well. This is very interesting to me. This is very interesting to me. I think in order to really understand the poll, I would probably need to ask another question, which is the reason for referral because in Ontario right now, medical professionals are required to refer? Or is it because you actually feel like referral is an appropriate thing to do? I think that would probably be a good follow-up question to ask on this. But what we're definitely seeing is, we've got out of the 43 who responded, 3 saying that they would actively do MAID, 2 saying they would provide the means for it, many more being comfortable with withholding medical care than with withdrawing it. So I'm going to close the poll. And we have to deal with the issue, at this point. So, questions or comments before we proceed to our first case? Dr. Kirshen has a note in the chat. What about discussing the issues with the patient in order to decide what to do short of MAID? Definitely a legitimate option for the poll. I hear that. Okay. So we're gonna go to case number one and have a look at the issue of medical assistance in dying. I will note for those who join late, if you want CME credit, even if you registered in advance, I still need you to sign in with a message to me in the chat or have your screen on, one or the other, so that I'll know that you were here. So looking at vignette number one, and it's just pulled from the Wikipedia page on the case of Rodriguez versus British Columbia. Sue Rodriguez was a 42-year-old mother whose illness, she had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, was diagnosed in 1992. By 1993, it was found she would not live more than a year. And so she began a crusade to strike down Section 241B of the Criminal Code, which made assisted suicide illegal. To the extent it would be illegal for a terminally ill person to commit physician-assisted suicide. She wants it to be legal to have what was not yet called medical assistance in dying. And so my question is, if Ms. Rodriguez were to be examined and found competent, would Judaism support her wishes, whether by actively ending her life, enabling her to end her own life, or referring her to a medical professional who would assist in MAID? That's the question that we're wrestling with here. So the first thing to recognize is that this is not a new issue. It's not a new issue in Jewish law. It's not a new issue in secular law either. If you were to take a look on your sheet at source number 7, you would see a note from a case that happened in the state of Washington in 1997. This is from, that was originally in Washington, ended up at the Supreme Court of the United States. Part of the decision in this case, the earliest American statute explicitly to outlaw assisting suicide was enacted in New York in 1828. You already had a prohibition against helping in suicide, Between 1857 and 1865, a New York commission led by Dudley Field drafted a criminal code that prohibited, quote, aiding a suicide and specifically furnishing another person with any deadly weapon or poisonous drug, knowing that such person intends to use such weapon or drug in taking his own life. Parenthetically, maybe not so parenthetically, when you have a law against providing these things for people, what does that tell you was going on? Right? You don't make laws about things that no one was doing. So this is not a new phenomenon. And indeed, in 19th century Germany, Rabbi Jacob Zvi Mecklenburg actually made a comment about this practice, commenting on a biblical verse. The Torah states, after the story of the flood, that if somebody kills somebody else, God will demand the blood of the victim from the hand of Adam, Miyad HaAdam, Umiyad Ish Achiv, and from the hand of Ish, his brother. So there's a redundancy. God is going to demand the blood from the hand of the man and from the hand of his brother. Says Rabbi Mecklenburg, there are two forms of murder. Harming the victim by avenging oneself upon him, taking his property and the like, that's one kind, that's the Adam, harming a person. Or benefiting the victim when he is immersed in great pain and he would choose death over life. That's the case of the brother. In other words, sometimes somebody kills another person as an Adam, as a person, and sometimes they kill mercifully. They're treating the person like a brother. The person is suffering and they want them not to be suffering anymore. And what he says is, the Torah is telling me it's prohibited in both cases, even where it is done out of brotherly love, nonetheless, it is still prohibited. So Rabbi Mecklenburg, writing again in Germany in the 19th century, sees a need to make the comment. The reason to make the comment is because people are doing it. Clear? Okay. So the issue of actively ending a patient's life is addressed in Jewish law at numerous places. I gave you one example. In source number 9, Rabbi Chil Michal Epstein was the rabbi in Novarduk in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And he said, source number 9, although we see that the patient is in great pain in his goses state, there's that word again, the patient in the last 72 hours of life is the way we're translating that right now, it will be better for him to die. Still, we are prohibited from doing anything to hasten his death. The world and all in it belong to God. Such is his will. That's what he writes, and it's brought by way too many sources to start listing them at this point. However, you do have to note that there are some controversial cases which appear in the Jewish literature, which seem to take us in a different direction. For example, the death of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion. If you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion was murdered by the Romans for the crime of teaching Torah to students. So what did the Romans do? I'm just letting somebody in from the waiting room. They brought him and wrapped him in a Torah scroll, bound him with vines, and kindled them. This is what the Romans did. The Romans felt that the teaching of Torah is the backbone of the Jews, and the only way to get those Jews to stop revolting is to get rid of their Torah. And so they said, well, we're going to light him on fire, and that's the way we're going to stop him from doing this. They brought wool sponges, but it wasn't enough for them to light him on fire. They brought wool sponges, soaked them in water, placed them on his heart, so that his life would not depart quickly. They want him to suffer in front of everybody. His students said to him, open your mouth and let the fire enter. He said to them, better that the one who gave it take it back and not that I harm myself. He says, I am not going to do anything that is going to hasten my death. So far consistent with what we're saying. But then the story continues. The executioner said to him, my master, if I were to increase the flame and remove the wool sponges from your heart, would you bring me to the next world? And he said, yes. And the executioner said, swear to me. And he swore. And that's what the executioner did. And then the executioner jumps into the fire. If you really believe that you're not allowed to hasten someone's death, even when they are suffering, how is it that Rabbi Chanina ben Tragyon misleads the executioner into thinking that this is an okay thing to do? Right? This should not be allowed. Right? We have a prohibition in the Torah. It's called Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol. Do not put a stumbling block in front of the blind. If the executioner is not allowed to hasten his death, then Rabbi Chanina ben Tragyon is not allowed to tell him to do it. So, how could he tell him to do it? What's the justification? What answer would you come up with?
It's not Jewish.
And therefore? The prohibition against causing somebody to stumble applies to Jew and non-Jew alike. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Gimel, for example, talks about giving a non-Jew food that a non-Jew is not allowed to eat, Erim and Achai, and it says you're not allowed to give that to him. You can't cause him to stumble any more than you can cause a Jew to stumble. Dahlia. Sorry, Dahlia, you can answer? I think you're frozen. So, Janine, yeah. But if being compassionate is going to mean that he's violating the law by carrying this out, in other words, he's not supposed to kill Rabbi Chanina ben Tragyon faster. So you're causing him to stumble. It sounds nice. We're helping him, giving the opportunity to be compassionate, but we're giving him the opportunity to break the law. So one approach, I see hands, but I'm also keeping an eye on the time. I'm going to take it a little bit further here. The one approach that's suggested is that the act of taking away the sponges, as the executioner did, was actually elimination of torture. It wasn't causing him to die sooner. It was eliminating an act of torture. That's one possibility. And the fire had been lowered beforehand in order to torture him more, so therefore he's just getting rid of the torture steps. That's one answer. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Ever Practical, says the prohibition against causing somebody to stumble is a biblical prohibition, but it's a relatively low-level prohibition compared to the suffering that Rabbi Chanina ben Tragyon is going through. So he said, yes, it's prohibited. However, compared to the suffering, it's overridden. That's another answer. A third answer, and this goes back towards Barry Pekus' question a little bit earlier, is that maybe a non-Jew is allowed to carry out a mercy killing where somebody is suffering, even if a Jew is not allowed to do it. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein raises this possibility. It's a big discussion. Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg discusses it in her Refuah Halacha as well. Maybe it actually wasn't prohibited for him. But however you resolve what Rabbi Chanina ben Tragyon did in advising the executioner that he could take out the sponges, the general rule is we do not end a patient's life. Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, in volume 6 of our Refuah Kahalacha, on pages 355 and 356, brings a long list of reasons why we draw the line at actively ending a patient's life. The reasons include that the patient's consent is not always clear-cut and willing. The fact that this is a permanent decision, taking the patient's life and perhaps waiting could lead to other solutions. The concern that society's judgment on what is a life worth living is a moving target and highly subjective. The fact that the giving a patient, quote, the right to die can result in pressure to exercise that right. And many, many more reasons for this. There's a lot to this. But that's the bottom line, is that when it comes to actively ending a patient's life, Jewish law doesn't seem to have wiggle room on this. The next step is the question of enabling the patient to take the patient's own life. I am not going to take the patient's life, but I'll write them a prescription. They can then choose what they're going to do with it. So, as a general principle, suicide is prohibited in Judaism. We do recognize personal autonomy as a religious value. However, the Gemara, it's in Bava Kamma, Tzadi, Amud Beis, 90b, did I bring it on the sheet? No, I did not. Sets the limit of personal autonomy as harming oneself. That's something that we are not allowed to do, and even where it's a matter of ending temporary life, where the person could not have lived long term. I brought you in source number 12 from Lord Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz, Chief Rabbi of the UK before Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. If you take a look in source number 12, the Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, my English translation is at the top of the next side. He presumably wrote this in English somewhere. He was the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, but where I saw it wasn't a Hebrew thing that he wrote, so fine. The value of human life is infinite, he says. We're not going to believe this for very long, by the way. We are going to draw distinctions between short-term and long-term life, but right now we're reading what he wrote. The value of human life is infinite, and therefore it cannot be divided. Each portion of it is infinite. It then emerges that the 70 years of life have the exact same value as 30 years, or 1 year, or 1 hour, or 1 second. This demanding definition of the sanctity of human life is founded not only on strict mathematics or logic, it is founded equally upon ethical considerations. If human life were to be diminished in value because its end was near, human life would lose entirely its absolute value and receive relative value, relative to life expectancy, health, benefit to society, and so on. So his argument is, every moment of life is like a full life. And again, we're going to disagree with him in a little bit. But that's what he puts forth as the reason why we would not allow a patient to, we would not allow suicide if someone were to consult about it. I see questions in the chat, which we're going to come back to when we talk about withdrawing and withholding treatment. So I'm going to come back to those, I hope, when we get to that. And again, there are a lot of reasons that are offered. The idea of the value of the life is one. We saw the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Epstein, earlier talk about how life belongs to God, and therefore it's not for us to make that decision. There are many different explanations for why, but that's the basic principle. However, inevitably, when you deal with this, you have to deal with source number 13. Source number 13, from the end of the book of Shmuel Aleph, Samuel 1, the story of Shaul, of King Saul. There is a war going against the Philistines, because in the back of the book of Samuel, there is always a war going against the Philistines. And this case, the Philistines are winning. Saul and his armor bearer are in trouble. And the war turned heavily against Saul, source 13. And the archers found him, and he suffered greatly from the archers. And Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Unsheath your sword and stab me with it, lest these uncircumcised ones come, stab me, and mock me." The Philistines in the book of Samuel are often known as the uncircumcised ones. There are a variety of reasons for it, not relevant for us right now. So he says to the armor-bearer, "Take my life, rather than let the Philistines capture me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he was very afraid. And Saul took the sword and fell on it. So Saul took his own life. "Ah, but didn't you tell me that suicide is not allowed?" So there are a range of answers that are given for this. Some say that he was indeed wrong. Even though we're taught that there were full honors for his burial, nonetheless, some say that this was in fact wrong. That's one approach. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg discusses that. Another answer is he was worried that the Jews would then come after him to save him if he was captured, and many people would die. So therefore he made the calculation to take his own life in order to save the lives of others. It was an act of life saving, not of life ending. Another answer is he was afraid they would torture him and mock him, and so in order to avoid that torture, he took his own life. Ramban gives that answer. But however one explains why this was okay, whichever approach one takes, everyone agrees this was bidi-eved. This was an after-the-fact justification. You're stuck in a situation. It's not a lechatchila. It's not advice to go do it. That's a basic principle. I'm going to just mention one other story just because I get asked about this story. Somehow, this story, which is from a very obscure source, has become popular anyway. It's from a Medrash in Yalkut Shimoni, source number 14. A greatly aged woman came before Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta and said, "My master, I have become too old. My life is now repellent to me. I do not taste food or drink. I wish to leave this world." He asked her, "What mitzvah do you practice daily?" She replied, "My practice is that even if I have something beloved to do, I leave it and rise early for shul each day." He said, "Keep yourself from the shul for 3 consecutive days." She did this, and on the 3rd day, she fell ill and died. So going to synagogue is keeping her alive. Staying home is what enables her to die. So people read that and say, "Hey, wait a minute. How is that? How is that allowed? Isn't she doing something that is going to cause her death?" What's the difference about her case? How do you know that this is not a model for suicide? Sorry? I hear somebody.
We would have all been dead by God.
Sorry, what, Janine?
It was caused by God. It wasn't that there was a direct...
Right. It's supernatural intervention. It's the equivalent of stopping saying Tehillim. Right? That's not an act of killing somebody. And if anything, it's also withholding care rather than withdrawing it or actively doing something. It's choosing not to go to shul. Going back towards one of the questions that was asked in the chat, I think Sam's question about praying for someone's death and the difference between passive and active. But people ask me this one a lot, so I figured I would mention it. One other note then. Since the patient is not allowed to end the patient's own life, providing the means of doing it is a violation of lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, not putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. Now you'll say, but they've passed all the tests. They know what they're doing. They're entirely competent. They're not blind at all. They know the prohibition and they've made a decision. However, if you take a look at source number 15, you find what the Rambam writes in explaining the rule of Lifnei Iver, and it's not just Maimonides, this is a standard view. Anyone who causes a blind person to stumble in some matter, giving him inappropriate counsel or encouraging those who transgress and are blind and don't see the path of truth due to their desires, violates the prohibition of do not put a stumbling block before the blind. So in other words, giving someone bad advice, even where the only reason they are blind, so to speak, is because of their desires, still violates Lifnei Iver. So even though they know what they're doing is prohibited, it's still called putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. Mark has a question in the chat. There are cases going back to the Crusades and mentioned in the Talmud about particular individuals committing suicide in order to prevent abuse. Those were highly, highly controversial cases, and I'm not going there right now. There's a lot to be said about that. Including abuse of that rule in the time of the Crusades. The Masada case is generally not approved, to answer Julie. Why isn't this a natural death happening after the shul going? I don't follow that question. Sorry. I thought I understood what was written there, but now I realize I don't. The bottom line out of this is that if a patient is not allowed to take their own life, I am not allowed to enable them to take their own life. Well, that leads us to the big question of effective referral. We in Ontario face a situation in which the College of Physicians and Surgeons has said that medical professionals are required to, not just when I say medical professionals, they're actually very broad and trying to make it even more broad. In terms of who is under this obligation, but if a patient is in a position where made might be, under the definition of made, might be indicated, then they are required to provide information about accessing it. This was litigated in Ontario. If you take a look at source number 16, the Christian Medical and Dental Society of Canada versus the CPSO, the College of Physicians and Surgeons, and they said, you're right. They said it does indeed impair the religious freedom or the right to conscience of the medical professionals. However, the part I bolded, the requirements impair the individual applicant's right of religious freedom as little as reasonably possible in order to achieve the goal. The issue is that your goal here, the goal of the law, is to help the patient, and that becomes important enough that the loss of freedom of conscience by the medical professional is overridden. That's their justification. So what does this mean in practice? Does this mean now that the observant medical professional is in trouble here? So we go back to a responsum of Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer. He was not talking about a medical assistance in dying case. He passed away before that actually became a legal issue. But he dealt with the question of a medical professional whose work is needed in order to enable a non-halachic abortion. Meaning, there are cases where Jewish law licenses abortion. There are even cases in Jewish law where abortion is required. But what happens if, let's say, someone is an anesthesiologist or a radiologist, and they are needed for some step before a non-halachic abortion is going to be carried out? Are they allowed to perform those background steps, or do we call that lifnei iver? And Rabbi Waldenberg said, you could actually justify the role of this radiologist, of this anesthesiologist. And his argument was that, number one, it may not be called lifnei iver. It may not be called putting a stumbling block in front of the blind if the assistance that you are providing is accessible elsewhere. That's a big, big debate based on a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, but there is a very strong position to say that. That's number one. That knocks the prohibition down to a rabbinic prohibition rather than a biblical one. Once you say that, then if the anesthesiologist says or the radiologist says, if I don't participate, I'm going to lose my job, then we can say, well, since it's only a rabbinic prohibition, then it's not really an issue of, then it's overridden by the concern for losing your job, since you've knocked it down to a rabbinic prohibition. Further, the rabbinic prohibition may only apply if you are helping during the transgression itself, not if you're doing it in advance. And there's more to be said, but the bottom line is that he comes out with a lenient position for someone who is forced to engage in that background step. Based on that point, and based on as well a concern that in the event you're going to say that that observant medical professionals cannot refer, you won't have observant medical professionals in the field, Rav Asher Weiss has said, Bikoshi, with great difficulty, that referral would be allowed. I gave you in source number 18 a link for an audio recording of a talk of his in Young Israel of Woodmere, and the reference to the time in the audio where you can hear him discuss the issue. So we do have room for it, even though really it's not what we want, and it's an extreme problem. Nonetheless, there is license to do that. In order to keep observant medical professionals is really what it comes down to. That's more or less where we end up on MAID. Questions and comments before we go further. So, Eitan, we did deal with the Lifnei Iver point before. It does pertain to non-Jews. I'm not allowed to put them in a position to violate something that they are prohibited to do. The one area where there may be a difference is, and I mentioned this briefly earlier, whether a non-Jew is prohibited from engaging in you know, euthanasia, essentially, whether they actually have that prohibition. But I'm not, that would take us far afield into many more sources, so I'm leaving that for now. Others? Yes.
What about the fact that it's readily available? I think a 1-800 number, in fact, it's common knowledge. You just have to ask your neighbor, how do I access assisted...
So I believe there isn't a 1-800 number. There is. That was one of the requests that was made. Meaning, when this debate has been going around and around for years now about the requirement for effective referral, and there was a push recently at the federal level when they were reviewing the MAID law to say there should be conscious protection enshrined in the law. Right now, it's in a preamble in the law, and it doesn't have any teeth. There was a suggestion of protecting conscience rights and saying that there should be some kind of federal resource with a website, a phone number, with information about each province for people within that province, and that would certainly lessen the concern for the problem of effective referral, you're right. However, to the best of my understanding, that does not exist right now. Dr. Kirshen unmuted, and he's in palliative medicine, so he can tell me definitively whether there is such a resource or not.
There's very definitely such a resource listed on the Ministry of Health website.
There is. So does that constitute effective referral to give someone the phone number?
I give them the URL and say, go to the Ministry website.
Okay, but I'm saying that would be recognized as effective referral?
Hasn't been tested.
Got it. Okay, that answers my question. But it's good to know then that there is a URL that I'm not so happy that there's a website to give people. But on the other hand, it's better than having to write out a recommendation to a physician.
Is that halakhically any different than writing out a requisition, giving them a URL?
Well, it's less assistance, effectively. And the reason why that matters is because within the law of Lifnei Iver, within this general prohibition against assisting others in sinning, and the specific exception of where the benefit is available elsewhere, then it's less of a concern. We require that the benefit that you provide be no better than what they could get elsewhere. So, one of the classic questions is, am I allowed to sell treif meat to somebody if my sale is going to be for a lower price than they would pay elsewhere, or if the quality of the meat is going to be better than what they could get elsewhere? Is that really called, it's just as available somewhere else? So the less assistance you're doing, the more likely that your assistance qualifies as something that's replicated that's replicable elsewhere. So in that sense, I think it does matter. Okay. So we're going to move from MAID to withdrawing care. I see more notes in the chat actually, but I'm only going to address the most recent one that I see, because when I start to scroll, I'm going to lose track of where I am. Does halacha judge someone who assists suicide favorably because they meant well, or do we throw the book at them because of the slippery slope? So the essential answer to this is that suicide itself is never judged in halacha. Meaning that we generally assume that if somebody takes their own life, it was because of an illness and pressure that they felt to it, and we do not, remove them of honors, and we don't bury them outside the cemetery and so on. And that's been something that, has been practiced already for a very long time. That's not a modern change. So we don't judge people, on that score. What would be the expectation for somebody who carried it out and now wants to repent and comes and says, well, what do I have to do? That's a very interesting question. I have seen some literature on it, but I don't remember it well enough right now to quote it. It is worth noting also, as was put in the chat, there is a process to assess individuals for MAID, and not all of them qualify. It's a fair point. Okay. So withdrawing care. Generally speaking, given our stance against suicide, my default assumption would be we don't withdraw care that is currently keeping a patient alive. However, take a look, please, at source number 19 on your sheet. Rabbi Moshe Isserles. writing in the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeya. He says the following regarding a case of a goses. And again, we're not really going into goses. What I am offering you is, as a translation of goses, somebody who is expected to die in a maximum of 72 hours. So he writes, one may not cause a dying person to die quickly, such as where one is goses for extended time and he can't separate, he's just not actually dying. One may not remove the pillow or cushion from beneath him, for they say that the feathers of certain birds cause this state. What that means, he's writing in Krakow in the middle of the 16th century, I don't know. But there was such a belief, and you can't remove the pillow or cushion, and one may not move him from his place. You can't move the body either. One also may not place the synagogue keys beneath his head to cause him to separate. Apparently that worked also. However, where something prevents the soul from departing, such as where there is the sound of knocking near the house, such as from a woodchopper, or there is salt on his tongue, and these keep the soul from departing, one may remove them. There is no deed in this. He is only removing an obstruction. Okay? Where something is keeping the person from dying, such as this sound from the woodchopper, or there's salt on his tongue, you're allowed to remove it. So, for generations and generations, people have been reading this line from Rabbi Isserles, from the Ramah, and breaking their heads trying to understand what the difference is between removing the noise and removing the salt and the feathers in the pillow, and so on. What exactly is Rabbi Isserles' position? And there are multiple explanations. One approach that's taken is to suggest that what he's saying is that we are willing to withhold life-prolonging measures from somebody who is a goses, but we're not willing to withdraw, reading this as withholding. So the woodchopper, we stop the woodchopper from banging, that's called withholding. That's one view that is brought. A second view that is brought is to say, no, this isn't withholding, this is withdrawing. And that we are indeed willing to withdraw life-prolonging measures from a goses in an active way. And then there's a third view, which is quoted from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, which says, we're talking here about what's called segula, not something that anybody would think works on a medical level, even in 16th century Krakow. These were considered to be folk things that people do, not actual medical treatment, and we're willing to withdraw things like that. So, we're going to come back to withholding in a little bit. But within the view that we're talking about withdrawing, that's really the focus right now, most halachic authorities are not willing to take the Ramah as justification for withdrawing care. However, three very significant halachic voices do seem open to it. And even though my Rebbe and my mentors did not take this view, I want to make sure to note these views. The first one is Rabbi Chaim David Halevi. Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, a major halachic authority in Israel in the middle of the 20th century, took the position that a goses is considered as though he had already passed away. He says, one is allowed to, he was dealing with a ventilator, to detach a ventilator. He says, if you take a look at source number 20, he says, the words of our master, the Rama, which is based on the position of the Shulta Giborim before him, are simple and clear. He is adding to Rabbi Yosef Karo, who had written previously, a prohibition against hastening death without actively doing so, but via segula actions, which only cause it indirectly. In other words, the beginning of what Rabbi Isserles writes, not about, not removing the pillow, whatever. He says, it's prohibited to cause the dead to die quickly, indirectly. And he brought the three examples, the feathers, the transport, the synagogue keys, the goal of which is so he will die. He says, that I'm not allowed to do. And then he goes on. This is Rabbi Chaim David Halevi continuing. First, he's saying, I'm not allowed to cause the patient to die. By removing the feathers, by moving the body, by putting in the keys. But then he says, I didn't write all of this to clarify the law regarding feathers in a pillow and a grain of salt. But the law of the grain of salt, that one may remove it from the tongue of the goses, is perfectly analogous to artificial ventilation, he says. permission to remove the grain of salt is agreed upon and obvious in the view of all authorities without dissent. And the essential reason is because this is only removal of an obstruction. He says you are removing something that is obstructing the person's death, and he says it's okay to do so. And the reason why it's okay, and sorry, and he says this is like the ventilator case. The ventilator is viewed as an obstruction to death, not something that is supporting life, because he views the ghost face as already dead. Now, remember, we said before, from Rabbi Lord Emanuel Jacobovitz, that all life is of infinite value, even the briefest. Nonetheless, he is telling me that that's not true for the Goseis. As far as he is concerned, the Goseis is already as though he is dead. He's not fully dead, but nonetheless, enough so that one would be allowed to withdraw the ventilator. That's the position that Rabbi Chaim David Alevi took. He was argued upon rather vociferously, but that was his position. Rabbi Menashe Klein, who I quoted earlier regarding the hydrocephalus case, said, you know, that's worth considering as well, although he didn't actually rule that way. Practically, he said it's worth a discussion. But that's one argument that is brought to justify withdrawing care in the case of a ventilator, is that this Rama would permit it. A second source that is brought in this regard is Rabbi Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, in source number 22. Rabbi Zalman Nechemya Goldberg and others disagreed with him as well at the time, suggested that one would be able to withdraw a ventilator, and he said, explaining the position of the Rama, well, you'll see it right here in source number 22. He says, there are two ways to explain the Rama's ruling that one may remove salt from the tongue of a goseis, or silence a knocking sound so that he will die quickly. The first way is that one who burns someone's food or medicine, causing the person to die of starvation, is not considered a murderer or even an indirect murderer. He has only violated the prohibition of do not stand by when the blood of others is shed for failing to save the other person. Therefore, with such a goseis for whom death would be better than life, there is no mitzvah of rescue, and therefore one may remove the salt and the knocking sound. In other words, what he says is, why is the Rama okay removing the grain of salt? He says, because all you're doing in that case is something that is indirect, right? By removing this, you're not actively killing the person. You're doing something indirect. The only prohibition that's involved is you're not saving the life of the patient. And he says, extending this person's life is not called saving it. That's his argument. That's argument number one. The other way to read it is, the second way, is that burning his food and medicine is viewed as indirect murder. And Rabbi Isserles, the Rama, only permits removing salt and a knocking sound because salt and a knocking sound are not a person's life. And so removing them does not cause death. These aren't really substantive cures, as opposed to withholding food and medicine, which is like indirectly strangling a person. So he says, those who disagree with me, in this case Rabbi Halperin, take the second view. They say the only thing I'm allowed to remove is that which is not really medical, like the grain of salt on his tongue, like the sound in the background. However, he says, I don't think that's true. I think the answer really is that withdrawing care is just another version of choosing not to save or extend their life, which doesn't apply to a goseis. So writes Rabbi Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. That's his position. I thank Rabbi Dr. Jason Wiener, who shared with me a letter from Rav Usher Weiss, in which he discusses this as well. If I remember correctly, Rav Usher Weiss was not a fan of it. He noted it, but I don't think he was a fan of it. Rabbi Dr. Steinberg also discusses this, as well as practical weaning options and what might be allowed by it. But the point is that you have Rav Chaim David Alevi, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, and consideration by Rabbi Menashe Klein in his Mishnah Halachos, taking this view that perhaps withdrawing a ventilator could be allowed, either because, in a case of a goseis, either because the goses is considered like they have already passed away, or because this person is suffering and all you're doing here is not ending the person's life, but choosing not to save them, and intervening to save them wouldn't really be saving them because they are suffering. Those are the arguments in favor. As I said, my mentors, my rebbeim, would not go for this, but there is such a view. Clear? Dr. Kirshen, yes.
I apologize for my poor memory, but it seems to me that there was at one point something from Rav Moshe about how to fail to restart a ventilator if one had to take a patient off a ventilator.
So, right, so what you may be thinking of is the Tzitz Eliezer has a discussion in Israel going back to the 70s about what to do with a ventilator so that it would be on a timer as one example, and then when the timer expires, you simply don't restart it. Because one of the key questions that comes up for those who are okay with withholding but not okay with withdrawing is, how do you really differentiate? If, for example, let's forget the timer case. Let's say the patient is on a ventilator. At some point, they have to stop the ventilator in order to clean out secretions or change something to prevent infection. If you simply don't renew at that point, is that called withdrawing or is that called withholding? So I think that's the discussion that you may be familiar with. If you take a look in HaRefuah KaHalacha of Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, it's in volume 6, page 359, he discusses options for weaning the patient from a ventilator and what's considered legitimate weaning such that you wouldn't have to put them back on if it turned out that they needed more help. So there is what to discuss certainly in that regard. I just realized I skipped the actual vignette for number 2, but you can see it on the sheet, the case of Mr. French, but I'm not going to go back to it right now. Okay, yes, Aurelia.
Own.
Yeah.
Israel intervened and said, we'll take the child.
Someone asked me a question, first of all, in the chat, wanting to know about definition of death. So I'm pointing to what I said in the very beginning, which is that's one of the topics that we simply can't get to. The issue of cessation of detectable neural function is just not doable in the context of this session. But one of the other issues which we will get to now under withholding care is the question of what justifies withholding care. So let me get to that, actually, because I think that will address this, and let me know if it doesn't. Take a look on your sheet at vignette number 3, going back to the first slide. Karen was a 16-year-old Catholic girl, the second oldest of 7 siblings. She was first hospitalized in September 1968 after a 3-week course of kidney disease. She did not respond to medical treatment. Renal biopsy revealed chronic active glomerulonephritis, and by the spring of 1970, a rapid decrease in renal function prompts the decision to plan for dialysis and transplant. Bilateral nephrectomy, removal of the kidneys, performed in 1970. Karen receives a transplant of her father's kidney the following month. At first, it functions well, but in March 1971, the kidney completely ceased to function. Prior to surgery, following the transplant's failure, thrice weekly hemodialysis was performed. She tolerates dialysis poorly, chills, nausea, vomiting, headaches, weakness. In early April 1971, after it became clear the kidney would never function, Karen and her parents expressed the wish to stop medical treatment, meaning no dialysis, and let nature take its course. That was the case I found in Case Studies in Medical Ethics. If Karen and her parents were to be examined and found competent, would Judaism support the desire to say, we don't want the dialysis, knowing what this is going to lead to? That's our question. Could one withhold dialysis because the patient says, I'm not interested? What would halacha say? What would you say? Yes, Julie.
Yes. Okay. So I would think it would be okay, right?
you know what, I'm not coming back on Monday. And that could be, well, you know, the care was stopped in the same way the ventilator was put on the timer and simply not restarted. This, I'm wondering if this is the same thing, you know, she goes in and just doesn't come back.
Well, I want to differentiate between the case of the ventilator and this one. Right? What's my standard for what level of suffering is sufficient to say we're going to withhold care? At what point does it just become suicide? Sam?
I think it all depends on the definition of, I think, if somebody's going to have a limited time of life, then that person is allowed to tell the physicians to withhold therapy compared to somebody that is going to live beyond a year. And then it becomes a bit more problematic.
So you're going to distinguish between long-term and short-term? So that it is a position, absolutely. There is no such thing as the position on this, but there's definitely a position. So first I want to note, before we go into the discussion of the different positions, halacha is very comfortable with powerful pain mitigation. Rabbi J. David Bleich, in an article in Tradition in 1996, advocates an expansion of research into alleviation of pain and permission for heroin and so on. For the patients. Right? Mordechai Halperin in Israel, wrote a responsum talking about continuous sedation, in which he said that would be acceptable, although I know that that's an issue among, palliative care physicians. Even in a case where providing pain medication might result in reducing lifespan, even if that is a result, where it's not a guaranteed result, and it's not the intended result, then that is generally considered halachically acceptable as well. There's a lot of discussion about this. I'm only noting it, and I brought you the Ramban in source number 23, who justifies where you're trying to care for the patient, and it does result in death, but that was not the guaranteed result. There was just a mistake made. And he says that's not called that's not called murder in halacha. Okay. A spectrum of views, though, on when we are justified in withholding care. We're going to see four different views. The first view, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, Rabbi J. David Bleich, you do everything. All life must be preserved. Rabbi Chanina ben Trajon would not open up his mouth in the flames. He says, let God take it back and not anything I do. Source number 24, I brought you Rabbi Bleich from his Tradition article. I underlined the key sentence, any distinction between natural and artificial means of treatment is without precedent in Jewish law. He says, all treatment is treatment. It's whether you're talking about oxygen, whether you're talking about food, whether you're talking about a feeding tube, whether you're talking about a scan, he doesn't see any distinction whatsoever. That's one position within this, and certainly founded on serious halachic sources. Second position, Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein brings this this position, and it argues that extending long-term life, even with suffering, is required. However, as Sam suggested, if you're talking about short-term life, then you don't extend it if the person is suffering. So in other words, you can withhold care, not withdraw. But you can withhold care if the patient can only live a short period of time and they are suffering. As a general principle, we do treat patients for chayei sha'ah, for short-term life. The Tiferes Yisrael, in source number 25, Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz points out that the Gemara in Yuma talks about digging somebody out of a ruin on Shabbos or on Yom Kippur when the building collapses on that person, even though they can only live for a short period of time. Why are we, you know, digging the person out? It's only going to extend their suffering if you take them out. He says, because we consider all life valuable, even if it is short. However, and that's consistent with Rabbi Lord Emanuel Jacobovitz earlier. However, take a look, please, at source number 26, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. He said, not so fast. Regarding the basic principle that one must do everything possible to extend the life of a patient, even though it is only temporary life. In truth, I also heard statements like this in my youth. but I do not know whether it comes from someone reliable. He says, this idea that you have to do everything, even for a short period of time of existence, he says, I don't know where that comes from. In my eyes, this requires great examination. For in Yoredeya 339, the Ramah that we read before, it is clear that one may remove an obstacle to the death of a patient, when that would also prevent great suffering. One only may not act upon his body. You can't, his distinction within that Ramah is you can't move the body. Synagogue keys, moving it from place to place. But the salt or the wood chopper, that you can get rid of. If so, then I see no reason to prohibit sitting without acting, where acting would increase suffering. Just the opposite, one should learn from here to refrain from acting. He says, you don't care for the patient where the patient is going to die soon anyway. That's his argument. And it's brought by Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein in source number 27. Based on what has been said, it appears that a patient may refuse surgery or any therapeutic treatment which involves great suffering. There is no obligation to pain him and cause him suffering with treatment that will extend temporary life. That's the argument. Now, what is the definition of temporary life? Everybody always wants to know. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says up to 1 year. Rav Asher Weiss says it's not about a specific number. Is the person on a trajectory of death from the current illness? That's what he calls temporary life. So my second view is, if the person can live long term, even if they're suffering, then you have to treat. However, if they can only live short term and they're suffering, then you can withhold. Third view, Rav Moshe Feinstein. Extend life only if they're not suffering. If the person is suffering, then even if they could live long term with the help you're giving, you don't extend. Rav Moshe's basis goes back to the story of Rebbe that we saw, who was dying, and the Ran, Rabbeinu Nisim, approving Rebbe's maid, wanting him to die. He also notes the Gemara that we saw in source number 2 about pain potentially being worse than death. He notes the Ramah, who we saw, about removing that which is preventing death. And so Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's verdict is, if you take a look in source number 28, in such people where the doctors recognize he cannot be healed and live, he will not live as a sick person without pain, he's not going to be pain-free, but they can give him medicine, which will extend his life as he is with suffering, then one should not give him medicine. Leave them as they are. Don't extend the person's life in order for them to suffer. And then in source number 29, he clarifies, because he was asked, is that only, like Rabbi Zilberstein said, for short-term life, but not for long-term? And he says, no. His Honor asked whether one should distinguish between temporary life and ongoing life. And he says, there is no, he says, in truth, I never mentioned this distinction. In truth, it is not logical to distinguish. And he goes on to say, you could argue the opposite. The position of Rabbi Feinstein is that we do not extend life, even long-term life, if the patient is suffering. However, both Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach drew the line at food and oxygen, saying that has to be provided. I brought you Rabbi Moshe Feinstein in source number 30. We saw Rabbi Shlomo Zalman in one of our early sources in the session, in source number 4, saying that food and oxygen are required. Of course, that leads to major questions. Does food mean a feeding tube? Does oxygen mean a tracheotomy? What exactly is involved? Like, how far are you exposed to go? It's not clear in these sources. Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg in HaRefua Kahalacha in source number 31 says not only do we require food and oxygen, but also routine treatment for other conditions that happen to be contemporaneous with the major terminal condition. So as an example, he says antibiotics for some infection that comes up, blood transfusions if the patient has great bleeding, insulin if the patient is a diabetic. You don't have an out of saying, well, maybe they'll die of something else along the way. He argues that that has to be treated. I have more about that in my shiur on giving up, which is linked at the end of the source sheet. If you look at the end of the source sheet, you'll see the link there for that. But that's your third view. So number one view, from Rabbi Waldenberg, Rabbi Bleich, do everything. Number two, Rabbi Zilberstein, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, they extend long-term life no matter what, short-term life only without suffering. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, don't extend a life of suffering. Someone asked me a question in the chat, what about someone who is not in pain? So here I go back to, again, what I said in the beginning, that we recognize psychological pain as well, as Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach noted, but I'm going to clarify further in a moment with view number four. View number four is from my Rebbe, Rav Herschel Schechter. And he says something that is entirely different from the views you've seen so far. And that is that people have a degree of autonomy to choose to refrain from treatment. He points out the Gemara in Bav Metzia, Daf Kuf Yud Beis Amud Aleph, which I brought you in source number 32, which, because it's already 8:22, I'm going to say outside of the text. The Gemara there is talking about a pauper who puts his life on the line in order to pursue a parnasa, a livelihood. He endangers himself by climbing a tree, doing construction work. And the Gemara is okay with the pauper doing that. So he says, you see that people have the right to take risks that are considered to be normal. That's a key idea. Where something is considered to be normal, something that normal people engage in. There are numerous sources that can be brought to support this. Chaim Odzer, the Chazon Ish, the Chafetz Chaim. And based on that, Rav Herschel Schechter in source number 33 says the following. If there are grounds to believe that all people, you poll people on the street, they'll all tell you, yes, give me that treatment in this situation. Then we push to give the treatment. Other extreme. If you believe that nobody would want such a treatment, you poll people on the street, they would say, no, don't do that to me. Then the answer is, you don't treat the patient with it. Don't even offer it to the patient. In between those two cases, where some people would say yes and some people would say no, it is up to the patient to make that decision personally. And that's not only about extreme care. That's not only about, some kind of something invasive, amputation or whatever. Having asked the Shaila of Rav Schechter in various cases, he applies it to food. He applies it to oxygen as well. The patient refuses. The patient is suffering. The patient is entitled to say, I don't want it. And his definition of suffering is not only extreme physical pain. It's broader than that. If you see in source number 34, Rabbi Zev Shostak wrote this up in the Journal of Halach and Contemporary Society, quite a few years ago, that one would not be required to provide, artificial nutrition and hydration. Okay. So that's your fourth position. Now, all these positions, all of them would agree that we withhold, quote, life-saving measures if they are actively harmful. Meaning, cases where CPR is actually damaging to the patient, a feeding tube where it's likely to lead to aspiration, IV liquids where the balance is hard and it could lead to edema and, drowning the heart. Yeah, these are cases where the rabbi has to be informed by the medical professionals of what the reality is in order to give a proper answer. But in those cases, even those who say do everything will not say do that. You have to know what the medical reality is and is it really good for the patient. One last point within this section, what do you do if the patient is unconscious or the patient is incompetent? So, again, that's one of those things we're not getting to here, but if you look at the end of the source sheet, you'll see a link for a class I gave on capacity and what to do with an unconscious or incompetent patient. I also happened to see this afternoon, someone sent me a flyer for the Torah in Motion Summer Bioethics Program, and I believe he's having a session on this issue of substituted judgment. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just go to Rabbi Kelman or TorahInMotion.org, and I'm sure he has the flyer up on the website. Happened to see it this afternoon, so happy to make the plug. But that's in terms of the different views on withholding treatment. I want to take the next 4 minutes just to talk about acute care because this is a late-breaking subject. Rabbi Dr. Judah Goldberg in Israel wrote an article in Tradition in the winter 2021 volume. I gave you a link for it in source 35, called A Halachic Framework for Decision-Making in Acute Critical Illness. And he ran his position past Rav Herschel Schechter and Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who agreed with him. What we're talking about here is not a case where we're choosing between allowing a patient to die or extending their life without curing them. What we're talking about here is where the treatment we provide might cure their condition and they could live longer. We don't know. It could also lead to great suffering. I gave you in the fourth vignette Rabbi Dr. Goldberg's own case that he gives there, a case in which a patient could experience great suffering if we treat her, or she could get better, and we just don't know. So the question now is, what does halacha say? Do we have to take a treatment which could really cure or could leave the patient in misery and suffering for years and years to come? So he makes a very interesting argument. He quotes Rav Moshe Feinstein, who we've seen already, saying that uncontrolled suffering can be worse than death. We saw that in Rav Moshe, we saw that in Rav Shlomo Zalman. And he notes that Rabbi Feinstein says, as I brought you on the sheet in source number 36, that a person is allowed to choose to avoid treatment if that treatment could cause death, in order to say, you know what, I don't want to go there, I just want to have short-term life as is. In other words, a patient has a choice between living out what little time they have without suffering, or opting for a life-extending treatment which could actually kill them now. And Rav Moshe says the person is entitled to forego that treatment. So Rabbi Dr. Goldberg says, look, if you're telling me that uncontrolled suffering can be even worse than death, then if I am allowed to choose short-term life over a treatment that could extend life or could kill, I should also be allowed to choose short-term life over a treatment that could extend life or could cause uncontrolled suffering. Right? Uncontrolled suffering being worse than death. If I'm allowed to opt out of treatment because of fear of death, I'm allowed to opt out of treatment because of fear of uncontrolled suffering. That's essentially his argument, which I brought for you also in source number 37. That's his position. And in fact, the recommendation which is approved by Rav Herschel Schechter and Rabbi Mordechai Willig, and you see it there in source number 37, is if despite unresolvable uncertainties, the overall likelihood of meaningful recovery is thought to be low, and the risk that critical care interventions will lead to outcomes that are subjectively worse than death is significant, then a patient should be given the room to carefully weigh the different options and risks. Now, the truth is, as Rabbi Dr. Goldberg writes in the article, it was certainly my experience over the years, I think that people commonly do this already. People routinely make this decision. People who are halachically observant make this decision. What he's providing is a halachic underpinning for it. But what I found particularly interesting here is what I brought you in 38 and 39. You may remember when the Carter decision came out from the Supreme Court of Canada to justify medical assistance in dying. One of the key arguments that they made was in source number 39, where they said, you know, if you won't assist somebody to die, you cause them to take their own life earlier. Right? Do you remember this argument? If you say, I'm not willing to help them die, I'm going to cause them to take their own life earlier because they don't want to be in a position in the end where they can't do it for themselves. That's one of their arguments. They said, the prohibition, it's in source 39 in the second paragraph, the prohibition, meaning against assisted suicide, deprives some individuals of life, as it has the effect of forcing some individuals to take their own lives prematurely for fear they will be incapable of doing so when they reach the point where suffering was intolerable. So at the time when the Supreme Court said that, a lot of people who were not fans of medical assistance in dying laughed and said, so you're telling me that you're actually a proponent of life by telling people that you're willing to end their life. However, Rav Schechter and Rav Willig make the same argument in source number 38 regarding acute care. They make the same exact argument. They wrote, in our opinion, this information that you can choose not to take acute care should be conveyed to patients and families as it could paradoxically be life-saving. The decision to intubate or not can be influenced by the fear of remaining on a ventilator even after there is no chance of meaningful recovery or of a return to cognition. If in these eventualities indefinite extension of a life of hopelessness or lack of awareness can be avoided by withholding further life-prolonging treatment, it is more likely that initial stabilizing treatments, including intubation, will be pursued. So they're making the same argument, right? Telling people you don't have to take a treatment later will help encourage them to take a treatment now. Obviously, it's not the same argument because they're not allowing medical assistance in dying. They're just talking about opting out of a treatment later. Nonetheless, I found that to be interesting. So I realized I did a lot of monologuing, so I want to make sure to do the review questions. I apologize for the monologuing, but I really wanted to get to the questions that people have been asking, and I hope this is useful. Number one, does halacha permit and for performing MAID or enabling it in any form for a patient who qualifies for MAID under the law? And the answer we said was that with difficulty, based on Rabbi Waldenberg and Rav Asher Weiss, one might permit effective referral, and hopefully giving the phone number counts, giving the website counts. What are two arguments that are brought to justify withdrawing treatment from a goseis? One argument, Rav Chaim David Alevi, the goseis's life is essentially over at this point. The other argument, Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, the patient is really suffering in doing this, and therefore you're not called saving their life by giving them this treatment, and you're allowed to withdraw based on the Ramah. What are the four positions regarding deciding to withhold care in terminal situations? So we said the four positions are either do everything. Do everything if there's a possibility of long-term care, of long-term life. But if it's just short-term, then you're allowed to withhold in the event that the person is suffering. Third position is you can withhold where a person is suffering, but you have to provide food and oxygen, and according to Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, care for other conditions as well. And then Rav Schachter saying, no, if it's something that not everybody wants, then one is entitled to decide that they don't want that care. And then the last position, the last question, what argument does Rabbi Dr. Judah Goldberg put forth to justify withholding acute care for a non-terminal patient? And the answer is that he says that suffering can be worse than death, and just like one is able to choose not to pursue a treatment which could cause death, they're able to choose not to opt for a path of care that could lead to great suffering. May all the efforts of the medical professionals be successful, and may we succeed in extending life and eliminating pain as individuals and as a society. Barry put a link in the chat, again, for the survey. I hope to email it out as well. I thank everybody for participating. I have to catch Mincha at 8:55. So I have 10 minutes that I can stay on for further questions and discussion. Please note, if you wanted a credit letter, please make sure that you either had your screen on or that you sent me a message in the chat. That's important. Thank you very much, everyone. Questions and comments. Oh, you can't tell me it was that clear.
So practically, what do we do?
In which case?
As a physician working in Toronto.
Right, but are you asking about the MAID case, the withdrawal case, the withholding case? So based on what I've seen, I think the answer has to be some combination of two things. Number one, it was pointed out, I think it was Dr. Kirshen who pointed out that you can have that conversation with them. You have to be very careful, I think, under the law. You have to be very careful about how you frame the conversation. You can't be imposing your ethics and your cultural values on the patient. But one option is to have that conversation with the patient. And I think that, based on Rav Asher Weiss and the idea from Rav Waldenberg, effective referral, giving them a URL, it sounds like is going to suffice. I think that's, as I said in the very beginning of the session, I really intend that this is just discussion of issues and not practical psak. I really believe that people should be asking the question of their personal halachic authorities, because so much of this is nuanced and based on who the person is and what they're dealing with. So I'm going to reiterate that here for sure. But that's what I'm seeing from the sources regarding MAID. And I'm really hoping that at some point the CPSO protects conscience rights. That would be good. All the other provinces do. Okay, anything else? I talked you into submission. Brian, you were going to say? Nope, or that was a wave.
Good night.
All right, good night, everybody.
Good night, Trichina.
Yes.
I have to say, you know, as a palliative physician, doing this with the patients, in my experience, most of the patients that have asked for it don't necessarily carry it out. But there is something powerful about them having that sort of option. That's my experience. The other experience is that, you know, patients are really suffering. And the ones that have done this are extremely grateful when it's happened. And the families are extremely grateful. I'm not talking about from a religious perspective.
Right.
And I can tell you there's a lot of suffering. And it's not right for everyone. Many people absolutely it's an abhorrent thing to even bring up. And I've had other patients where it's almost like, what a gift that you brought that up.
Yeah, you know, I thank you, and I'm very happy that I didn't turn off the recording before. Sometimes I turn it off before Q&A. I'm happy I didn't in this case, because you're pointing to something that I usually emphasize when I speak about this, and in my rush to get through everything, I didn't hear. It's really, really important. And I'm talking to a lot of medical professionals here, I can see, who know this, but it's really, really important to stress that these people are suffering and in immense pain. I mean, you talk about ALS as a very extreme case, but even people who are not dealing with ALS, people who are considering this are in great pain and often don't have good options for, you know, ways to mitigate that. And this isn't something they're doing in a trivial way or on a whim. This is something that they wrestled with in cases for years before coming to it. And as a Jew, you know, and in terms of what the Torah teaches, we have to be empathetic. We have to feel the pain that these people are feeling. And it's not as simple as blithely saying, well, we don't allow it. This should be, in every single case, a painful decision. So, you know, I don't mean to take it lightly, and I've read the accounts of, you know, of people whose families say they're so glad that they did it, and I don't minimize that, and I don't, and I don't question that. I think I'm stuck, you know, from a halachic perspective, but I think it is important, and thank you for pointing it out, you know, that we emphasize. And going back, it really goes back to what I said in the beginning, which is there's a need for humility on all sides in this conversation, because of that. Yes, Dr. Saffer.
When you were talking about Rabbi Taradio, it seems to me that before him, all the discussions were in theory. He was in the midst of incredible, incredible suffering. So can we judge him for what he said when he was in the middle of terrible, terrible suffering?
Right. And that's, I mean, I'll say two things. Number one, I would say that the fact that the Talmud brings the story makes it fair game for legal discussion. Even if the answer at the end of the day is his case is different because he is suffering, nonetheless, it makes it fair game. But number two, is that goes back to one of the answers that was given for why he was able to advise the executioner that it was okay to remove the sponges. We asked, aren't you misleading the executioner? And one of the answers was, he is suffering greatly. I think, Rabbi Dr. Tendler gives that answer. He is suffering greatly, and therefore, the lower level prohibition of don't cause someone to stumble is overridden by the fact that he's in great pain, pointing to the, you know, to what you're saying. He's being tortured. Absolutely. This is an issue. I'm going to stop here. God willing, tomorrow I'm going to send out a follow-up email with the link to the recording and so on. With information about upcoming programs. And you should be getting an email about topics for next year as well in the coming days. Thank you very much, everyone. Be well.
Thank you.